Our speakers today, we have two, have firsthand knowledge and experience in addressing today's topic, and they're going to share that with us today. And our first speaker is Scott Friedland, who's a sergeant with the Champaign, Illinois Police Department. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
Scott's also one of our trainers at the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center. Scott, tell us a little bit about yourself, your rank, and what you do there in Champaign.
Okay, I'm a sergeant in charge of alcohol enforcement for the city of Champaign. In that role, I have the distinct opportunity to be in charge of about 145 licensed establishments in our community. Illinois is a little different in that the enforcement responsibility falls on the local community as opposed to states and a number of states around the United States. And so with that, we do a number of enforcement strategies, including compliance check investigations, of which I've been doing about 9 years' worth, or over 3,000 checks. So that's
been pretty
big. Big part of my job.
Okay, and our second speaker today is Raul Almeida. He is chief of the Matteson Police Department, located in Matteson, Washington. And if you think Matteson is a small town and not much happens in a little town, well, let me tell you, if you remember the mad cow disease scare we had several months ago, well, that happened in Matteson, Washington. Welcome, Chief.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Yeah, it was definitely an adventure.
I'm sure it was, with all the media attention and so forth. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your department.
I'm a chief of police. Well, I'm a chief of a small agency. Being a small agency, we also run the Yakima County, which is our county task force. We do the underage drinking, so we actually have a DASA, which is a grant for underage drink for the whole county. Been doing that now for probably at least 7 years, been in law enforcement 23 years.
Wow, well, welcome to the program, and we'll get with you here in just a few minutes. Scott, you're up.
Thank you. My role and responsibility today is to basically give you some foundation on how compliance check investigations work. And I think it's important to convey a couple things right up front. One is that compliance check investigations are just that. They're compliance. They're not a program designed to get licensees to try to make licensees fail. It's the idea is that we want to have them be a part of our community to run normally and run properly, and the only way we can ensure that they're doing that is to conduct these types of investigations. Some people refer to these type of investigations as covert, some refer to them as stings. There are some terminologies that don't necessarily favor the mindset of being a program designed to be cooperative and encourage compliant behavior. What is a compliance check investigation? Well, obviously, it's an enforcement strategy that focuses on the point of sale. And this can be on any kind of age-related product. Alcohol and tobacco are the most common, obviously. And it uses a number of underage decoys, or we have other terms that we use for these young people as well, like cubs or covert. And what we do is, in a controlled environment, we give the opportunity for a licensee to refuse the sale of alcohol to our underage person. The primary focus on this is conducting a fair test. We don't want to set the business up for failure. We don't want to entrap them. We want to have the system be set up in such a way that if the seller does the job correctly, then, in fact, we have the benefit of knowing how well they're operating and can really prevent the sale of alcohol to minors. Now, there are a number of benefits, if we can go to the next screen, please, that relate to this. And first and foremost, it helps determine the accessibility of alcohol to our minors in our community. Whether it's the tobacco product or the alcohol product, we want to make sure that the minors don't have easy access, and this is one of the primary ways of doing it. It does reduce the youth access to these controlled products and helps promote server-seller practices by giving them a test system that makes them more honest in their operations of their jobs and the performance of their jobs. And in the long term, then, by doing this, it helps reduce alcohol-related tragedy and other types of tragedies associated with other age-related products. So obviously, we're talking about a reduction of death and associated alcohol-related crimes and problems. So next screen, please. Here in Champaign, we've been doing compliance checks for a number of years. We actually started our program around 1989 or 1990. I've been keeping very significant data with regards to our compliance rates. And as if you have the computer-based presentation up, you can see we have a graph showing our per-inspection rate and our per-business rate. Now, to clarify this, What we're really talking about here is the per inspection rate. If I do 100 inspections in 1996, for example, if I did 100 inspections, 78 of those inspections were task-based inspections. If you look at the other rate, the per business rate, this really judges the business's ability to perform correctly and helps identify businesses that have a pattern of misbehavior, a pattern of problems. And you can see that we tend to have a higher rate of businesses that pass, and our ultimate goal is to get everybody passing all the time, obviously. And as you can see, as we've progressed, we've been able to maintain or continually increase our compliance rates to exceeding 90%. Now, it's important to realize that when I first came on, realizing the needs of fair play and compliance checks, that we were seeing a 40% compliance rate prior to the data you're seeing here. And it was the idea of us working together in a comprehensive way, providing a variety of enforcement strategies, and working directly with the retailers and educating them on the proper sales techniques and how to prevent the sale of alcohol to underage, that really helped bring about the levels of compliance we're getting. And the numbers you're seeing, the percentages you're seeing, are really based on somewhere between 250 and 300 compliance inspections done per year in our community of 145 licensees. So, now, in addition to having the community benefit by showing these compliance rates, the industry also sees a benefit. And as we look at the screen now, it talks about the fact that it helps identify these problem establishments. In my communications with my licensees and my opportunity to work with licensees around the United States, it's pretty evident to me that most owners want to operate correctly and most owners want to do things to ensure that the kids are not getting the alcohol into the hand or into their hands. And so this really helps identify the problem establishments and allows for focused attention on those establishments that are causing problems in our areas. It also helps us build relationships between the local industry, their employees, and the units conducting the compliance checks. When we walk in, obviously we don't want to be readily identifiable as those people doing the compliance checks, but we do want to be able to have a situation where if I send officers in and there is a problem, that the industry can feel comfortable in calling me and saying, what can we do to improve our performance? What can we do to change this to prevent these types of things from happening? And again, realizing that the majority of these folks don't want to have the sale of alcohol to minors. It helps to establish our community norms. Most communities, I think, are really strongly against the sale of alcohol to minors. And this, again, conveys that type of concern by doing these types of inspections and investigations. And it also encourages them to become better community members. Most communities, I think, recognize the need for these businesses to be part of our community. And, again, we simply want them to be a proactive part where they really can be a good neighbor and do things in accordance to our community standards.
Scott, let me ask you a question. Are most of the business owners there in Champaign, are they, do they live in the community?
No, I mean, I would say a majority do, but we also have, like most communities, the chain restaurants, the chain stores. And so while you have some local mom and pops, you also have the big corporations. And again, in dealing with a lot of those, most all of them want to have that level of cooperation with the community and be a good neighbor. So.
Be a good community business member.
Exactly. Now, the next screen that I have up is another graph. It really shows that there's a lot of strong benefits to doing compliance checks. And the trends that we have seen here in Champaign over the few years that we've been doing these, or several years we've been doing these. In particular, what you're looking at is the fact that once we start compliance check investigations, along with the comprehensive program and educational programs, you can see that we have had a steady decline in the number of businesses that have had failures, as well as the number of failures overall per inspection. And actually, as you look at this graph, what you see is an increase in the number of licensees. We've gone up significantly in the last few years. As a matter of fact, the last couple of years, we've increased by 10 or 12 licensees, the number in our community overall. And at the same time, we've increased the number of licensees, we've brought in good partners, created that good attitude, and decreased the number of businesses with failures. And at the same time, and what I think is most significant is, over the last 3 years, we've not had any businesses that have had multiple failures. That's significant in terms of identifying businesses that want to comply and want to do things right. If we can reduce the number of businesses that have multiple failures, then we're obviously making some headway in preventing the sale of alcohol to minors.
So, Scott, for those folks who don't have web access, you started these checks, it looks like, about 1996.
That's what the data got up to. Actually,
yeah.
It's been longer than that.
Okay. So your total number of licensees were about 140?
Right now we're at 145. We actually at one point had right at 120 in the late 90s. And since that time, we've had continual growth in the number of licensees.
So in your failure rate in 1996 looked like it was about almost half.
Yeah.
And so over the years, like in 1997, it was about the same. But after 1997, I don't know what happened, but it really went down all the way now to 2004. I mean, it went from almost half of the licensees all the way down to maybe 15 failures.
Yeah, and actually, I think it was 13 to be exact, and we had no businesses with repeat violations, and that equates in our community to about a 92-94% compliance rate. I don't have the exact number right in front of me, but that's what we've been running this year, is 92-94% compliance.
That's really great. By the way, folks, if you have a burning question that you'd like to ask Sergeant Friedland from the Champaign, Illinois Police Department, you can dial 01 on your touch-tone phone if somebody in your group there wants to ask a question of Sergeant Friedland. During his presentation, punch 01 on your touch-tone telephone. He'll put you in a question queue, and Braden, our operator, will take care of you. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I did want to point out while we have this screen up, and one is that one of the reasons I think we see such a significant decline is the fact that we do work directly with the licensees. We provide a lot of training. We have a voluntary server training program, and in the last 6 years, we've had over 1,400 servers of alcohol come through that training program. That training program and the certification is good for 3 years, so you can see that we're having an impact in that way. In addition to that, we also encourage businesses that if they have a failure to contact us, and we go in and we're more than willing to help them out in terms of identifying what the weaknesses might be that allowed for the sale to occur. We give them roughly 30 days to make modifications before we go back and do another compliance check investigation on them. So we're giving them time to improve their situation, move forward with things, and we're showing our interest in having them be a good neighbor as well by providing the things that we think are important to them being successful in that endeavor.
So in a way, it's a partnership between law enforcement and the retail community to work together to do the right thing, abide by the law, and reduce youth access to alcohol.
Exactly. And as is the case, anytime you start a new program, one of the things that comes up is there's a number of concerns that would be expressed. And if we go to the new screen, one of the things, to the next screen, I should say, one of the things that always comes up is, what is entrapment, or, this is an entrapment type situation. I've looked at video interviews from media outlets when these programs are starting, and it's always this, gee, I've been entrapped, this was not fair, they were setting me up for failure. Well, one of the things I think is important to realize is what is entrapment, and basically what we're talking about is enticing, coercing, or compelling someone to do something that they would not normally do. One of the things I point out in this screen also is the fact that what's the difference between this and a regular drug investigation? We have to keep in mind that alcohol is a drug. While it's legal, it is a legal drug that's age-regulated. And so, in fact, when we're talking about the access of alcohol to youth, we're talking about an illegal activity. And so we should be able to use the same formats that they do in other types of drug investigations, whether it be narcotics or prescription-based drugs, which are also legal under certain aspects. Obviously, if you have a prescription, you're good to go. The other thing that gets expressed frequently is the consistency in enforcement. We want to treat all of our licensees equally and fairly, and by doing that, then we create that relationship where they know. I'm not afraid to tell a licensee about my program. I'll be happy to come in and show them exactly how we do the compliance check investigations. Short of telling them when we're going to be there and providing them pictures of who my kids are going to be doing and checking, I'll tell them virtually everything else about the program. I think the other point is the honesty in conducting the check. We are going to talk about the training element of our youth, and one of the things that's really, really important is to make sure the youth understand what the goal of the program is. It's a fair check. It's not that we're out to get the licensee. It's not that we're going to try to make the licensee's life miserable. We're trying to provide a fair, honest opportunity for the licensee to be successful in the refusal of the sale. And those are the most important things that we want to be able to do. Now, as we do that too, one of the things that I'll frequently tell licensees as I'm training them or working with them is you follow three simple rules. And in those three simple rules, you'll never have a failure of compliance check. And they come back to carding principles, one of which is set minimum carding ages. And don't make them 21. If I'm doing a minimum carding age of 21, there's a strong likelihood that I'll be selling to minors. But if I set a minimum carding age of 35, then I've dramatically reduced the opportunity for a sale of alcohol to a minor because I'm going to be requesting IDs for anybody who looks under that age of 35. Verify the identification. You know, if you are comfortable with the identification, we ask the licensee to ask for additional forms of identification and go through a process of verification to ensure that this person is the right person that's presenting the documents. And then lastly, if they're unable to produce an ID or if they're unsatisfied with the ID, most businesses, I don't know of any business that is compelled by law to sell the product to a person that they're not comfortable with. So they have the right of refusal, and they're basing it on sound principle of, I can't verify the age of this individual, so therefore I'm not going to sell them the product. Those are really some important things to do. Now, in setting up these programs, we do want to talk about some basic things. First off, it's important to realize that a lot of states have developed over the years some standardized procedures for conducting these compliance check operations. And so one of the things I'm going to encourage everyone to do as they start these is check with your local regulatory bodies with regards to alcohol, whether it's ABCs or other organizations, revenue, that are involved in the sale of alcohol or licensing of alcohol to see if there are, in fact, standard procedures or guidelines that the state wants them to follow. And if there are, then adapt those as standard for your community. That's going to ensure that we're operating within the guidelines that the state has set up, and it'll help us ensure that we are successful in pursuing cases against those licensees who choose not to be that good neighbor, as we've talked about. Another thing that we want to talk about is meeting with the key leaders and prosecutors. Now, frequently what's going to happen is when you start a program and you have a failure at a business, that business owner or business manager may go straight to the community leaders, the mayor, the city council members, and complain about this. So it's important for them to understand exactly how these programs are going on and hopefully get their buy-in into the process so they understand that our goal is the fair check, and by doing that, then they can be supportive of what we're trying to do. Same thing with prosecutors. Depending on how these cases are pursued, some communities will prosecute them through the local level, others will do it through the state criminal level, and even others will just simply do it through the administrative process through their local ABCs or their state enforcement regulatory organizations. So it's important that we follow guidelines that the prosecutors are willing to accept and to work with to ensure that we're getting the right kind of outcome.
It's really preparing the community too, Scott. You're really laying the groundwork to make this a successful operation for everyone.
Exactly. And the more we get buy-in from everybody, if we have the media outlets come to us and say, what's going on here, what are these programs about, not only do we in law enforcement, for example, have the ability to speak, but we also have community leaders who can speak to the issue as well and say, this is something that's really important for our community as a whole. So we get that additional buy-in and our community support all the way around.
And there are no surprises.
Exactly. And that's the one thing that will cause your problems, is surprises. The more we try to keep these under standard procedures, the less opportunity there is for errors to occur that create those surprises, or acute political emergencies, or apes as we like to call them. The more we avoid those, the better off we are.
And you're really being, for law enforcement, you're really being proactive in getting the program off the road or on the road by getting everybody who's going to be affected by this or could be impacted by this program to understand what the program is, feel comfortable with the program, knowing that you're doing it professionally, there's training that's going on, and there's one purpose behind it, and that's compliance. It's not like you're trying to catch somebody. So when you have all of the players who are going to be impacted in some way or the other on board with the program, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it?
Exactly, and that goes to the last point on the screen, for those of you who don't have it, basically we're going to talk about the education of the merchants and the merchants' employees. I think it's really important to get the buy-in of the industry itself and those that work within the industry. Many people will get into these jobs for a variety of reasons. Some may not take that job as serious as they should, and by taking the time to educate the merchants and their employees, we give them more of a sense of responsibility with that position. We're better able to have them buy into the concepts and do the job the correct way. So, now, one of the key components of this is the youth component. I think it's really important that we have an ability to draw youth in that are going to match the environment that they're going to be working in. There are a number of sources that we can draw these kids from, youth police cadet programs, family and friends of officers, a whole variety of things. As you can see from, if you have the screen, we give you some ideas, and again, there are a number of resources out there. A lot of times the referrals are really good because they can point to kids who've got an ability to properly act in the environment and do things the way we would expect them to be done. Along with recruiting youth, it's going to be extremely important to train those youth properly in what we want them to do, what we want them to say, how they're acting, how they are to appear. We don't want a kid who's basically setting the business up for failure. You know, a young man who comes in with this large, with a full facial hair, that is one of the things that would cause us problems in the long run with that licensee, because then they do feel like they're being set up for failure, and that creates the barrier to us being successful and gaining the compliance. We also don't want them to lie about things. We don't want them to come in and say, you know, I'm 21, and try to convince the person to sell them alcohol. So we want them to be very truthful in their communication. I like brief personally. The briefer they are, the more likely it is that we don't run into some of the issues where they expand too much and maybe get themselves into trouble. So we really spend a lot of time training the youth on how to act correctly and the things they're to do and purchase during the course of these compliance checks. We also need to make sure that these youth are agreeable to testifying in administrative actions. Sometimes we do wind up with youth who are a little bit more nervous about that. They think it might be fun to play the undercover cop, so to speak, but at the same time, when it comes down to testifying, they become a little bit more nervous about it, and then we end up losing the case because their ability to perform in the administrative action or court proceedings becomes much less. Now, as we work with these youth, it's going to be important, just like any CS or a source that we use in any kind of investigation, we want to document this individual's youth through a variety of forms and in a variety of ways. We want to do a personal history form so we know as much about this young person that we can, including the criminal history, driving history. We want to look at the potential or the need for waivers and permission forms. An agreement of understanding is basically setting up the youth with the rules of operation and making sure that youth understands exactly what they can and cannot do. That's going to be critical for moving through the program, because then if there are problems where the youth is not acting correctly or we have issues related to the performance, we can come back to that agreement of understanding, point those issues out, and try to either correct the issue or take care of the problem by the elimination of the young person from the program.
And doing a criminal history is also important to make sure that you're not surprised in case you have to go to court or some type of a hearing, that the attorney for the defendant doesn't have some criminal history that you haven't checked, and then you find out that this person has a reputation of drinking underage. You sure wouldn't want that surprise in a case.
Yeah, the embarrassment of going into court only to find out that your youth has been arrested 3 times prior for alcohol possession as a minor really will create doubt about your program. And it will also, you know, obviously cost you the case more than likely, because now this person's got a history that can be pointed to, and we know those types of things do come up in court, so it's important to guard against them by ensuring that we've done the appropriate checks. As is another check that we talk about, which is the age test verification, we want to be in a position where we can verify public perception-wise what the age of this person is. If we have a young person that is working for us, and we take them to a retail outlet, non-alcohol, for example, and just simply have them stand out front, and as people are coming and going, trying to get them to estimate the age of the individual, then when we go into court, we can actually build our case much more efficiently by showing that the public perception of this young person was that they were clearly under the age of 21, and so therefore, when we're when that person's able to make a purchase, we can submit that as additional evidence to help support our compliance check investigation. So, moving on to the next screen, there's a typical setup for these types of things, and they do vary from community to community on how these operations are established. Most commonly, it involves a team of officers, volunteers in the community, and youth to go in and do these compliance check investigations. These compliance checks don't have to be set up solely and operated solely by law enforcement. They can be done by a variety of people, and certain components can be done by citizens or coalitions, that type of deal. Some of the legwork can be done, some of the support with community, and some of the observations can be done with community volunteers. Law enforcement will need to be there to take care of some of the issues directly, and that will be an important part of it. At a minimum, a team should involve a minor decoy and a surveillance officer. That's absolutely the minimum you should go. You never want a minor decoy going out and conducting compliance checks on their own. And you do want to have a law enforcement component available if you're taking an enforcement strategy. If you're doing an audit strategy where you're simply trying to establish the pattern of behavior of that community, then, yeah, you could do it with all community people, making sure that the minors are protected and that the operation is run on the same standard as it would be if it were law enforcement, short of actually making the full-blown purchase. Once you've done that audit-based inspection, acknowledging that the business failed or passed their compliance checks through the notification and documentation of that activity. One of the important components of this is also to make sure that our youth are protected. And so when we're doing these types of operations, especially when we're talking about off-premise locations where the sale of alcohol is to be used for off-premise consumption or away from the location, those are frequently targets for robberies and those types of activities. So to be able to go in and check the location, ensure that the location is a safe location prior to the youth going in is going to be an important component of that. Also reducing the likelihood of contact between the seller and the youth after a point of sale to ensure that we don't have a seller who kind of goes ballistic. Assignments may vary from minimum, like we talked about, to several teams. I'm aware of communities who do what I call a shotgun approach, where they'll set up multiple teams and in one day they will hit 100% of their licensees, to other formats where they have an ongoing program similar to what Champaign has, where we would do compliance checks, you know, two or three times a week. We do just a few locations each time, and we spread it out throughout the entire year. Some locations will use officers both in uniform and plain clothes. That's not an uncommon format. Plain clothes are your surveillance officers. Your uniforms are the ones that are going to go in and actually make the arrest. One of the other components of preparing for these compliance checks is location selection and the frequency of enforcement. It's important to realize that we have resources that may be limited in some cases, and so we want to get the best bang for our buck. And the way we can do that is determine exactly what the community needs are with regards to these compliance checks. I know some communities involved in the conference call today are site communities that are required to do, for example, off-premise locations only. And so in those types of things, that's the direction they're going to have, and maybe we're not going to get to the on-premise locations. So this gives us an opportunity to have direction on where we're going to do it, where we're going to go, and how frequently we need to do these checks. You can do a single compliance check per licensee per year. You can do as many as one a month, depending on what your resources are. And again, that's going to dictate the frequency with which you do these investigations. We can also do these selections based on a general random selection. All license types can be checked, and we randomly select, you know, pull them out of the hats or computer-generated selection process, however we can do it. These are all important ways. We can also base on outlet types, for example, the convenience stores, the grocery stores, and maybe do one series of investigations where we focus solely on those types of outlets, then coming back later and maybe doing another type, or simply doing one base type all the way through until we're done, and then seeing what the results are. We can also focus these on geographic locations. Are they close to a college community? Are they close to an area that has a high history of DUIs, things like that, where we're focusing kind of a community policing type effort to change the behavior in a particular area. Another common way of doing this is also complaint-driven selections. We receive complaints, we're going to respond to those complaints, we're going to conduct a compliance check at those sites. One of the things that goes with complaints is that if we do go in, I encourage licensed or individuals conducting compliance checks to have a program established where failures generate additional inspections. Example would be, I have a small convenience store that has a history. We go in, we get a failure. Now we're automatically going to set them up for additional compliance checks to ensure that we're changing the behavior. We're going to notify the licensee that that's what's going to happen, that, you know, we've got this concern. We're going to offer them the training, and then we're going to do the follow-up investigations to ensure that we're getting some kind of change in behavior. Again, focus on the problem areas. Continuing on, in doing this, the inspections, we want to select our locations in advance. We should know where we're going to go. It can be 15 minutes before we go out and do it, but we should, before we go out in the street, simply have an idea of the locations we want to check, not just a random, well, let's see who's busy tonight. This helps us maintain that sense of fairness. It also allows us to look at the past history of those locations. It also allows us to have an idea of the layout. Some locations now are being much more careful about the sale of alcohol. They're isolating the alcohol displays in certain areas, and it's important for our minors to go in and not have to ask a lot of questions about where the alcohol is at. So if we know our locations, we can direct our kids directly to the area they need to go to make the purchase, thereby reducing the possibility of detection, and again, creating an element of fairness and dealing with the location properly all the way around. Okay, we don't need to buy, for example, kegs of beer. A six-pack, a single serve can oftentimes take care of the issue of the purchase. You know, we don't need bottles of Dom Perignon. So when we go in, we should brief the entire team on the layout, the history, and what types of products we would expect them to purchase while we're there.
It's important to have a good plan written down rather than kind of doing it on the fly, isn't it?
Oh, very, very much so, because if you do it on the fly, you're going to wind up with problems. There's no doubt. You'll have things that you'll leave it up to officer discretion or creative thinking on the part of officers, and those are the ones, those are the types of situations that will ultimately wind you up in a complaint of entrapment or improper performance, or those types of cases also a lot of times will not follow standard business protocol or operational protocols that many states have adapted. So having that plan, making sure everybody knows how these things are going to operate and the setup is going to be really, really important. Everybody's got to be on the same page before they go in and begin these inspections. So making sure that's done helps ensure the success of the program and the fairness of the program. Now, as we go on, we also talk about the safety standpoint. And again, I kind of touched on this earlier about making sure that we know what's going on before we send our minors into a program. After some 3,000-plus compliance checks, you know, knock on wood, I've not had any serious issues at all. I would not like to see a situation where a minor walks into a robbery in progress, because you put the minor in a very bad situation where he's going to react inappropriately, maybe alert the bad guy that the police are outside in an effort to try to get away, and now we've really created a potential hostage situation. So that scanning is really, really important. If you have the capability, some states do, of doing audio or video recording, I think it's a good tool to have. It's an excellent tool for training purposes to help improve the performance of our minors. It's also great evidence when we go into court. So if you've got that capability and have those resources available to you, I would highly encourage compliance check operations to use those types of programs or those types of equipment. Another thing that's really important in the safety aspect is making sure the minor has a certain level of authority to terminate an inspection. If for some reason they walk into that establishment and they see someone they know, or for some reason the hair on the back of their neck stands up and they just really feel uncomfortable, they should have the authority to be able to turn around and walk out of that establishment without conducting the compliance investigation. And that's simply because we're going to be more detectable if we're nervous. We want them to be relaxed. And the bottom line is we always have another day that we can go back and check that particular business. It doesn't have to be checked at that particular moment. Maybe there was some legitimate reason for that young person to be nervous about what's going on. So we want to have them have that level of authority. We also want to make sure we do have plans developed for emergency circumstances. I'm aware of cases where the business has been checked a couple of times, they've had a couple of failures, they've been encouraged to work with the police, and now a minor comes in who happens to be working for us, unbeknownst to them. They attempt to make the sale of alcohol, and when the seller detects this, they reach out, grab the minor, and then press the alarm button. Ironically enough, that's the way that they're reporting this to the police of the illegal sale, and it does create more of an emergency environment. Or the person who then all of a sudden realizes they've been, you know, caught in a compliance check investigation and maybe tries to come after the officers or the minor. So we want to make sure we've got some emergency plans developed for those types of circumstances. In conducting these, the entry timing is important. I think Chief Almeida is going to talk about that a little bit as well in terms of some of the stats they've developed with regards to timing. It is important to take into consideration the business activity and business volume. I don't want a compliance check being conducted when, for example, if I'm doing an on-premise location, it's maybe 11 o'clock at night and there's a line of 30 people waiting to get in the establishment. That's not necessarily a good time to do a compliance check because the business is busy. It's not an effective use of resources. So maybe if we moved it up a half an hour, where we're coming in a half an hour earlier, we avoid having the lines, but the business has a certain level of business volume occurring that makes it so that our minor is not as easily detected. Some of the businesses will have varying hours. You know, you may have businesses that only operate between X and X, and we may have to modify our compliance check investigations to allow for those types of factors as well. We could clearly say, hey, we can do 100% of our licensed establishments, but in reality, that may be more difficult. There are locations that have private clubs, for example, where memberships are required. Sometimes those memberships are rather expensive. Again, dictating resources would tell us whether or not we would want to do that and the process in which we would take care of that business's compliance check. So there are certain factors that will come in doing these as well. The enforcement timing is also a factor. Our community many years ago had a system set up where we required all of our servers to have a name or number. And when our miners were going in, they would make the purchase and walk out. And one of the primary responsibilities of the miner was to identify the server by number. The ticket was then not issued for a week. Now, please understand that was before my time. So it was a situation where then the officer who was in charge of alcohol enforcement at that time would have to go back to the business and contact them later. That was not an effective way of doing these enforcements. We lost many cases because we weren't able to support all of the allegations and the failures that were occurring and make the appropriate identification. So when we're doing enforcement, we may want to do this shortly after the violation occurs to ensure that we're catching the right person who's doing the sale and taking care of the business the right way. Now, as we do that, we also want to make sure that the business gets recognized for the passes as well, and we'll probably suggest doing that after your compliance operation is done for that evening. So you would do them, address the fares as you need to, those businesses that pass. One of the things that always concerns us is the phone tree or the phone networks where businesses may report out their activity to other agencies or to other businesses that maybe we haven't gotten to yet. So by holding off on some of those, we can still give the recognition to the licensee that passes without risking the entire operation for the evening by having a phone tree kick in.
Scott, we only got a few more minutes, so you can go ahead and continue.
Okay. Standard reporting methods should be used, and when we're talking about that, again, following the state guidelines, some of the elements of the investigation that help in terms of going into court would be the employee training, documenting that, store signage, any use of ID checking devices, also documenting the employee's presence. And then one of the critical elements is always having a photo of the minor as they appeared at the time they conducted the inspection. So that should all be included in the investigative record, and then that record should be submitted for prosecution or administrative action. To kind of wrap this up then, the results, when an employee passes a compliance check, the information should be passed on to the manager. We do want to go back and provide recognition and rewards to the compliant businesses. If this program is not about getting the businesses in terms of the bad boy businesses, so to speak, if we're really promoting the idea that this is a compliance program and we want them to be compliant, we need to pat them on the back when they do a good job. That can be done through a simple format of a letter that just recognizes their efforts from maybe a governing leader of the community or mayor or county board chair, things like that. To even more significant rewards, some locations will hand out T-shirts, others will hand out pins. One of the things that we do here in Champaign is we request, not require, but request our licensees to come up with their own reward system whereby our licensees will reward their own employees. I have one licensee, for example, that if the seller refuses a sale on a compliance check investigation, we give that notification to the licensee. The licensee then, at the end of the business day, will reward that employee with $250 in cash for incentive to do the job right. So, again, that focuses on the positive behavior. It recognizes the employee as well as the businesses that were compliant. So that kind of wraps up that end of it. I think we'll probably talk about media here in a little bit as well, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah,
specifically.
If you don't get the media involved,
it didn't happen?
It didn't happen. And we'll talk about that here in a few minutes. Thanks, Scott, and hang around for questions coming up later in the program today. And by the way, for those of you who may have joined our call late, our topic today is compliance check investigations. We also want to welcome some of the folks who are in the community trials project across the country. I see folks from, see Dr. Rodriguez there from South Florida and the Brevard Community Trials Program that's going on there. Our folks up in Connecticut and out in California and Missouri, we welcome all of you folks to the program today. For those of you who, as I say, may have just joined us, we're going to be doing something a little different before we go to our question and answers following Chief Almeida's presentation. We're going to be doing an electronic evaluation of today's presentation, so you don't have to fill out all that paperwork. We'll be doing it. You can either do it online on the web presentation, if you've got that up today, or you can do it by touch-tone telephone, and we'll have Braden explain that to us a little bit later. Our second speaker today is Chief Raul Almeida, Chief of the Mapton, Washington Police Department. And, Chief, welcome to the program today, and you're up.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it. Well, Scott pretty well covered as far as what a compliance check looks like. I'm going to talk a little different. We're going to talk about what we did and as far as what we used as far as stats. Big, we can't do it. I appreciate that we're getting the credit as far as the law enforcement goes, but we can't do it without the community, without the media, and definitely Liquor Board and some of the other establishments as far as organizations out there. So we're going to talk about compliance check, and hopefully you got it on there. You can see our PowerPoint. If not, we'll go to the next slide. We talked about compliance check. Compliance checks are a proven strategy to reduce availability of alcohol. We found, and what we did is we did a database to collect the information, and we found that, excuse me, that a lot of this does work. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through, give you some numbers, and we talked about some of the other things as far as age, gender, and everything. So what we're looking at is that in the United States, youth were able to go into establishment stores to buy alcohol without being asked any questions for ID or anything 50% of the time. To me, that was pretty troubling when I first saw it, and so we definitely knew we needed to get aboard. So what we'll do is we'll move to the next slide. And what I'm going to give you is some information, some data that we collected from 7 reducing underage drinking projects in the state of Washington. We also got the information from the LCB, which we call LCB, which is the Liquor Control Board. They're the premier ones for us here in Washington State. I mean, that's their bread and butter. They do it all the time. We in law enforcement jump in and help out, but a lot of this information came from them and then our RUAD states.
Now, what are your RUAD states?
RUAD communities. We had Yakima County, Benton County, Grays Harbor. We had several. We did 7 communities that we got this information from. We did over 4,000 compliance checks. So the information I'm going to give you is what we're doing. What we do is we all collect. We all came up with a state standard, believe it or not, state standard form where we collected all the data, and then we sent it up to Aaron Starks, who works out of Olympia, awesome guy. He's the one that's collecting. We've now been able to actually map it, find out where we're doing it and everything. We're going to be at the conference. We're actually going to show you what we've been able to do with the mapping and just collecting this information. For me as a chief, it was important to know how's my community doing, where am I at, where are we missing the boat. So it was important for us to get this data. So when somebody asks us how are we doing, well, we can actually tell them how we're doing. We found that use of compliance checks were consistent with the research. They do work. The more compliance checks that were conducted, the higher the compliance rate. We're looking at is that can you get to the point where you can't do it? One thing we did find that, and you can also go to the Liquor Board LCB website, and you can type in Washington State Liquor Board website, and hopefully a question answer will have it for you. But you can go there and you get monthly stats as far as what's going on. So that is awesome. Since they've been doing compliance checks since 1998, the compliance has increased. So that was consistent with what research had told us. We also found that the RUAD communities, reducing underage drinking communities, tended to have a higher level of compliance because we were doing more compliance checks. And we found that prior RUAD communities, year later, 2 years later, were at the state level or below, just because they dropped off and weren't doing the compliance checks. One thing we found that we got a very high level of compliance, and I'll talk about that, but we were never able to achieve 100% for everybody. So we'll talk about that here in a little bit. Then there were some questions we were asking ourselves. Is there a difference if the minor volunteer is a male or a female? And so the gender of a minor, we call them volunteers. We don't pay them. I know they call them operatives, and I think Scott gave you a list of what the other names they call them. But the gender of the minor volunteer did not appear to affect the outcome. What we did is we used a female. We had about 83% compliance check and 17% non-compliant. A male volunteer, we had 82% compliance, and we had 18% non-compliance. So it wasn't a real, real big difference.
So if anybody said that females make more buys than males, it really doesn't pan out that way, does it?
True, true. And then there was a couple things, you're right, and some of the things that I thought, and kind of, you know, this kind of, you know, shot some of my mind too, that I thought, well, this is what I thought, but this is actual, you know, we track and research. Then the big question was, is there any difference if there's a clerk, and we call them clerk servers, whichever you want, you know, depending where in on-premise, off-premise, is if it's a male or female. The clerk, the gender of the clerk, did to us, remember we're only a year into this, does not appear to affect the outcome. We found that a female had 82% compliant and 18% non-compliant. The male had 84% compliant and 16% non-compliant. And that was a clerk server. Then the next question was for us, does it make a difference if a volunteer is the opposite gender of the clerk server? So we want to look at that. So if we had a female clerk and we had a female volunteer, what kind of numbers we'd get? We came up with 84% compliant, 16% non-compliant. Then we had a female clerk with a male volunteer. We came up with 80% compliant and 20% non-compliant. So there's a little difference there. We found that now we had a male clerk, female volunteer, we came up with 82% compliant, 18% non-compliant. Then we had the male clerk, the male volunteer, we had 85% compliant and 15% non-compliant.
So there is a difference there, isn't there?
Yeah, so we did find some. There was a few differences as far as the males and the females, and we'll talk about ages and other stuff here. And then, does the age of the minor volunteer affect the outcome of the compliance check? We found that volunteer age does impact the outcome. Scott talked about age testing. We think that's critical. You need to do age testing. For us in a small agency, you can't do it all yourself, so it's important that you get a community coalition. You get them involved. They can help you do it. They can help you recruiting. Scott talked about that. For us, the big thing, and obviously Scott talked about that too, was the object of the compliance check is to provide a realistic challenge. We just want a realistic challenge, not to deceive them. We're not there to trick them. I'd like to know in my agency, in my county, where are we at really, not how much can we trick them. Then the age of the age and appearance will provide a more realistic assessment. What I want to know is that if I, you know, stick in a, for example, we had a volunteer age 17-year-old with a compliance was a 17-year-old volunteer. We had a 90% compliance and only 10% non-compliance. We had a volunteer who was 18 years old and they had an 83% compliance and 17 non-compliance. Then we had a volunteer that was 19 years old, and we had a 78% compliance and 22% non-compliant. What we found out is that some of the, you know, established themselves, hey, you know, these are little kids. It was pretty obvious. It was a no-brainer. As you start getting closer and closer, and we'll talk about some other stuff. As you start getting closer to the age, then they needed to do a little more thinking, and then, you know, they were able to get through. So if you stick in a, you know, 12-year-old, well, you're probably going to get 100%. But if you get more realistic, you know, a 19-year-old in there, 18-year-old, you're going to have more of a realistic assessment of your community.
So as someone who's 17 is not a real challenge for some folks when you want to challenge the community realistically. But when they get older in age, up to 19, the compliance rates go down.
What we found is that also the age testing was really important. The community told us this young person looks like 22, and there were only, you know, 17, 18. Well, we thought, well, we better not use them because it was to the point where we getting to the point where maybe we're looking at possibly seizing because a lot of people are telling us that. So we tried to keep them between the age of 18 and 19. And then the other one was, does the age of the clerk and server affect the outcome of the compliance check? Well, we have some younger clerks and we have some older ones, and we have some younger servers and older servers. What we found is that if a clerk is under 21 years old, they had an 83% compliance and they had a 17% non-compliance. Then we went from 21 to 29, and we had a 76% compliance and 24% non-compliance. Then we went from a 30 to 39, we had 83% compliance, 17 non-compliant. 40 to 49, we had 85% compliance, 15. I'll jump up to basically 60 and older. As you notice, as we got older and we got more compliant, obviously a lot of them, most of them were probably owners, but we still noticed that obviously the older people were more compliant. So we were actually, they were definitely on top of it.
So the youngest were more compliant, the oldest were more compliant, but that age group between 21 and 29, as far as clerks and servers, they had the worst compliance record.
Yeah, and we'll break it down here in a few other slides, too. We even broke it down a little farther. Then we looked at it. What if it was a volunteer, was a female, and that the volunteer age was 17? We had an 89% compliance and 11% non-compliance. We had the same. We had another female who's now 18 years old. We had an 87% compliance and 13% non-compliant. We had a female who was 19 years old. We had an 80% compliant and 20% non-compliant. And then we did the same thing. We had a male volunteer. He was 17 years old, and he was at 94% compliant. And again, same thing went back. You know, it wasn't a real test, at least some of the comments we got. We had a 6% non-compliant. 18-year-old, we had a male with 81%, 19% non-compliant. The 19-year-old was a 76% compliant and 24% non-compliant. So it does make a difference.
Yeah, it does. It's interesting that how you would use that data in your training, because if the rule is if they don't look 35, you need to check their ID. If I were doing that and I was trying to increase the compliance rate on older kids, I'd really be stressing that in my training.
Agree. And what we wanted to do right now, I'm just kind of giving you the raw numbers and everything. The plan is to give this to, this is why we're doing the compliance check. Everybody says, why are we doing the compliance check? Are we making a difference? We believe we're making a difference, but we wanted to have some real numbers to say, yes, we are making a difference. Then, what I loved out of this is that now law enforcement, you know, LCB and other places can now look at it and say, okay, where can we make? There's a couple things as far as, you know, that we still haven't come up with solid numbers, so you know, I won't go into a lot of it, that we're looking at. Do we need to change the times we're actually doing it? I believe that, you know, Fridays, Saturdays, you know, Thursdays are times to do it, where the numbers, I think, are going to come out a little different. We're going to talk about it when we get to San Diego at the conference. We're going to talk about it. I think there was some things that even changed my mind. So that's why I thought it was very important. We also looked at the, Bill, you keep me on task as far as time goes. We looked at a female clerk, and the female clerk was 21 to 24. We had a 63% compliance, and we had 37% non-compliance. Then we had a male clerk between 21 and 24, and we had a 71% compliant and 29% non-compliant. So here you see that the female, 21 to 24, clerk, was 37% non-compliant. And we did the same thing with a female and male, 25 to 29. And we found that the female, 25 to 29, was 80% compliant and 20% non-compliant. The male, 25 to 29, was 81% compliant and 19% non-compliant. So those numbers were pretty close. I think it was a big wow for me was 21 to 24-year-olds, males and females, so 37 versus a 29 non-compliant.
Yeah. Do you share that with the industries or the retail establishments?
Well, we just started putting this together. So you can actually go, like I said, LCB is awesome. So you can actually go to their website, look, tells you where everything is going on as far as how many compliance checks they did. I'm going to jump track here a little because it's really important. I think Bill said it. You know, if you did it, nobody knows, it never happened. So for us, it's really important that we work with the media, that we develop a positive, proactive relationship. Probably wouldn't recommend it to everybody, but, for example, I have several reporters have my pager number, and obviously they can call me dispatch. So they can page me when things are going on, plus I can track them down and advise them when we've got different events coming up, when we have compliance checks. We actually take reporters with us writing, and they get a chance to see it in real time. They don't report it till after we're done, but they get an opportunity to see it. It's a real eye-opener, and then when the reporters doing their show, they really have a passion for it because they actually saw it. It's not just us telling them. They're actually seeing it. They believe it, and they believe, like, wow, how could this happen? So we always notify the media in advance. We tell them what's going on. We don't tell them where it's going to happen. We just tell them, hey, we're going to come out. We're going to be doing it this day. Are you interested? Yes, no. And then if they are, we just tell them we're going to do it, and we tell them that we have these weekends coming up. What's your plan? And we get with them. We can use media to create and demonstrate community support, and that's important. If you go out there and the reports of these terrible things that, you know, is going on, or these kids, or the great things are going on, that the community is actually making a difference, you get support one way or another, or it's a real eye-opener. We invite the media, again, to ride with us, to sit with us, and we go through it. We don't allow the media to photograph our youth. We use police explorers. For us, that's really important. For us, we use police explorers. They're used to the contact cover theory, they're used to as far as communication. We have, and Scott talked about, we have some emergency procedures as far as how they can communicate with us without radios, with radios, all kinds of stuff. We give some key information to the media, what we're doing, what's going on. We give them some of our state stats we talk about. We also give them some of the prior information that I'll provide for you at the end. What we tell them is what the percentage of retailers sold to our volunteers, and how many retailers asked for ID. So that's what we did. We said we did, 30 of them. This is how many sold. This is how many asked for ID. These guys asked for ID and still sold. And that sometimes will blow you away. And some will look at it and say, okay, and kind of do the math in their head and press on. And then we look at it, how many had warning signs. And obviously the most reporters are local, so they know their community and they know the retailers and they know how many signs are up there. Usually the managers get pretty upset as far as, that their clerks aren't doing a good job. And some are doing an awesome job. So we want to make sure, like Scott talked about, we want to make sure we reward them and we let them know. Also, we give them information as far as what type of business. As far as a convenience store, grocery store, gas station, all kinds of stuff. And then we had asked some of these questions, are younger clerks more likely to sell to older clerks? Are two clerks more likely to sell than others? So we got some numbers, that we're still working on that one too, as far as do more clerks and then less clerks. We found basically, and it's not on your slide, but we found that a clerk alone at a store is about 83%. Compliant, 17 non-compliant. Then we had one or two with about 79%, 21 non-compliant. We found three or four employees at 88% and 12% non-compliant. We found that five or more employees with 90% and 10% non-compliant. But one thing, we're still working on these numbers, but one thing we found, or at least we're seeing as far as us locally, they could have five employees, but if the five employees are three stockmen and the manager and somebody in the clerk still by themselves, it was more where the employees were instead of just how many employees. So we'll still work on some of those numbers for you. And then we talked about, does it make a difference as far as male, female, kind of talked about what we see. Now, the big question is, what's going on in your community, and are you seeing different numbers? That's why it's important to know where you're at, kind of get the pulse of the community, find what's going on. We let them know what's going on. When we got our RUAD grant, we told them what's going on. We made a big media event. We told them why we're doing it. We want to educate the retailers. We want to let them know what's going on. And here's training. LCB provides the training for you and get them aboard. We want to let the public know. We want to talk about policies. And the big thing for us is we also want to involve youth. We have a youth advisory board who actually go and can see what's going on in courts. They can, you know, send out information, come to council meetings. They're involved in telling us how we can help reduce underage drinking. And then, obviously, enforcement, we can do the follow-up as far as penalties on the clerks, penalty on license holders. Find out what's going on in court. You know, let's find out, you know, are they getting cited? Are they getting administrative? Is it an administrative hearing? Are they getting penalties? Are they losing licensing? So LCB can help. Then if you look at the resources, PIRE has a documentation called Reducing Alcohol Sales to Underage Purchasers. It's a practical guide, awesome information. You can find it at www.udetc.org, and I'm sure Bill will talk about it. Bill, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chief. And there you see, if you're on the web, you see a cheap picture there of the Chief way up in Madison, Washington. I want to thank you for being on the program today. We'll get with you here in just a few minutes to see if we have any questions for you or Sergeant Scott Friedline, who's also with us today. I want to say hello to our folks up in New York with the community trials. Also, I noticed we have some folks from Hawaii and just all over the country here who are participating in today's program. And we're going to be doing right now an electronic evaluation of today's presentation. And this is a first for our audio teleconference series. We're going to see how it works. It's going to save you some time on the paperwork for those of you who are participating today. And Braden, our operator, if you'll give us the details on that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, of course. At this time, we will conduct our evaluation session. I will read each question followed by the answers. You will then select the number that best answers the question by pressing the corresponding number on your touchtone keypad. I will read each question, and then I will read the answers twice. Please wait until I have completed reading the answers a second time to make your selection. Our first question today is, what was your overall rating of the program? Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. That was 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Please make your selection now.
And if you're on the web, you can also do that. A screen pops up, a little box, and you just click on your answer and hit answer, and that'll tabulate.
Moving on to question number 2. How would you rate the ease of the audio conference registration? Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, or 4 for poor. Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Please make your selection now. Our third question is, how would you rate the clarity of dial-in procedures and registration verification? Again, press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Please make your selection now. Our next question is, how would you rate the ease of joining the online presentation? Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. That's 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 somewhat good, and 4 poor. Make your selections now. Our next question is, how would you rate the audio quality of the conference? Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. That was 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 is somewhat good, and 4 is poor. Please select your option now. For our next question, were the handouts of value in supporting the presentation? Please press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Again, that's 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Please make your selection now. Our next question is, how similar was the actual program versus the advertised content? Press 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Once again, that's 1 for very good, 2 for good, 3 for somewhat good, and 4 for poor. Please make your selections now. Our next question is, was enough time allowed for the presentations? Press 1 for yes or 2 for no. 1 for yes or 2 for no. Please make your selection now. Our next question is, was enough time allowed for discussions, questions, and sharing? Press 1 for yes or 2 for no. That's 1 for yes and 2 for no. Please make your selections now. Our final evaluation question today is, would you participate in another OJJDP audio conference? Please press 1 for yes or 2 for no. 1 for yes or 2 for no. You may make your selections now. This will now conclude our polling session.
Okay, thank you, Braden. Don't forget, if you have a question for our panel, the code to enter on your touchtone telephone is 0101. We'll get you into the queue. We're going to bring in here Holly Torsky, who's a senior program manager at the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center. She's out in the beautiful state of Hawaii on Oahu. I'm not going to ask her what the weather is. She'll be... I know she's having a great time out there on the island. And, Scott, I wanted to ask you a question here before, as people are trying to get into the queue for questions by punching 01 on their touch-tone phone. You know, it's interesting when you were talking about going into the establishments and talking to the permittees, the clerks, the managers. You know, it's almost like the Neighborhood Watch program or when law enforcement was being proactive, going into businesses to prevent break-ins, both in houses or neighborhoods. It's kind of a risk reduction assessment, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. We have found, really, that that's built a relationship when the business owner and the business employees can come up and say hi and know who they're talking to and know that they have a source that they can turn to when they have problems. And it goes beyond just alcohol issues. It's all types of problems that you see. You know, they have employee theft issues or other types of issues that come up, shoplifting, those types of things. All can be a benefit to you by just spending some time with them.
Yeah, that builds those relationships, too, making it a positive experience. Holly, jump in here and talk with us a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, aloha, everyone. Well, I did find the presentation to be quite interesting, and in fact had a couple of comments that I wanted to make and to have the speakers expand upon in a little bit broader context. One of those was the discussion regarding the photo of the minor decoy. There are certainly various points that need to be made about the importance of why a photo of a minor should be made. And before I have Scott or Raul expand upon that, I wanted to just make a comment that what we have been shared with from many police departments is that oftentimes they will use the photo taken during the night of the check to be used as a reference point when that minor decoy appears in court, which could be quite a bit later from the time frame that the check occurred, so that the youth dresses in the same manner in which they appeared. Scott or Raul, could you expand on why that's important and what sort of time delay there may be between when the actual check occurred and when a court appearance may actually occur?
Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. From my end of things here in Champaign, I know that our cases are usually fairly quickly adjudicated or going through the administrative process. So, you know, here we're probably talking a month to 2 months on the long side of things. Now, obviously, with delays and different types of administrative proceedings, it can go longer. From my standpoint, one of the biggest benefits of having that photo is taking in the field with you. And you will have vendors who make demands to see the minor. One of the things that we found that had a great deal of success with is by having an extra copy of that photo that we can show the seller or show the manager, what that's done for us has resulted in a lot more pleas, because now you have a manager who says, well, who was the minor, and you show them a picture with no identifying information, and the manager then says, I cannot believe my clerk sold to this person. What, were they nuts? You know, those types of things. You can tell from the picture that the kid was underage, and so it brings about the end result of less cases going to court in the long run.
Yeah, and I guess I would jump in there, too, is that we use a picture, but we actually attach it to the police report. So if they go to court, the defense and the prosecutor can actually look at it, and the judge can look at it and see what the actual age is. We ask the kids to dress the day that, to dress the same way they dressed, and hopefully that's not a problem. We tell them to dress the same way they did that Friday when they went to school. And no extra makeup, no nothing, and we keep it. And, of course, we've done the age testing, so we know where they're at.
Okay, thank you. Braden, do we have any folks in the queue for questions?
Yes, we do. We have Ken Gale from Lansing, Michigan.
Ken Bell from Lansing, Michigan. How are you doing, Ken?
Good. How are you folks doing?
All right. Go ahead with your question.
Good. I had a question. The National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, their report, one of the recommendations having to do with compliance checks, talks about kind of the signarization, if you're familiar with that idea from tobacco compliance checks. But it's basically telling states that they need to be accountable for a certain compliance rate, and of course that would have to be done through the compliance checks and the kind of stuff that Rudy was talking about, you know, as far as the data collection statewide and kind of statewide procedures and stuff like that. I just wanted to get kind of thoughts and feelings on that. Do we think that this could move us in a good direction? Could it move us in a frightening direction? Kind of what are your impressions on the idea of a state having to be accountable to a certain compliance rate?
Guys?
Do you want to talk about that, Holly, or do you want
to? I'll actually defer that to an enforcement perspective.
Okay. Well, what I'm looking at is that we haven't established any, you know, you must have a 90%, 80% or anything. To me, it's really important that I can really feel good when I go to a council meeting, when I go to the community and I say, you know what, we're actually making a difference, we're checking, our retailers are doing a great job, and if they're not, then I need to be accountable why we're not, and then I think I need to be the guy who has to, you know, use the measuring stick and say, you know, this is a problem. But we found who's doing well and who's doing bad. We found that we have a great success, but we have a few establishments that they're just trying to make a buck, and they don't care where they make it. So that's the only one. So I don't really see a real frightening thing there, but Scott?
Well, and I come from Champaign, obviously, which is a twin city with Urbana. We're a university environment with 38,000 students just at the University of Illinois. The interesting dilemma we face here on occasion is the fact that, you know, our neighbors to the east don't do compliance checks. So to have a certain level of push maybe would be beneficial. I know that the neighboring communities do the sign-our checks through tobacco, as do we. And so maybe there is some real positive in it things. I think a lot of people look at it and say, do I want Big Brother pushing me or you know, forcing me to do things I don't want
right.
to? But I think at the same time it brings about a certain level of awareness of the problem and makes us all more accountable for it. So I don't know that it would be a bad thing. I think it would probably bring some people more on board. At the same time, you probably have some resistance in some communities as well.
And that's something that would be decided at the federal level rather than the local level. But certainly those that are doing compliance checks can set their own standards as far as compliance rates. I mean, you're really looking at community norms. What's the norm in the community, and what will the community tolerate?
Mm-hmm. You know, for our community, for example, we wanted to get to that 90th percentile and be able to maintain that 90th percentile. And it took us several years to get there, but it was through having those kinds of goals and directions that helped us develop the types of programs that we have, especially when we're talking about the educational component and working with our licensees.
Absolutely. Our next question. Braden?
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, Holly, do you have anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I did want to make a note that Scott had mentioned during his presentation that although compliance check investigations themselves, where citations and warnings are issued, are conducted by enforcement, that community members can be involved in what we call alcohol purchase surveys, which is a non-enforcement activity where community members can go out to establishments to survey the compliance of retail outlets on requesting of ID. What's important about that is that that information can be critical in helping to supply some baseline data that can be utilized to the media to help build community support and garner support around future enforcement activity if, in fact, compliance checks have not been conducted in the past in the community. Scott, Raul, would either one of you be willing to perhaps talk about how that can benefit enforcement efforts?
Yeah, I'll talk about it. We actually take law enforcement with us when we do the alcohol surveys, and that gives me a good opportunity. And I try to do as many of these as I can, so I'm not just the chief that sits in the office, actually out there with those guys, and we actually see it. We actually can use community members, and we use our explorers. We go and we can cover a large area pretty quick because we're just doing the survey. Then we come back, kind of gives us a baseline of where we're at. Community members are the ones tracking all the information, so we can move pretty quick. We're there as far as law enforcement. That's the only thing I feel more comfortable about is we have a law enforcement officer there just in case if we do, Scott talked about it, if we do have some, robbery or some kind of assault or something going on, we have a law enforcement officer there. But pretty much run by the community, we do a good survey, we come back, we got community members that are helping us put everything together. It's awesome. You couldn't do it without the community. There's no way. It would cost a lot of money if we did.
From my standpoint, too, in terms of the public perspective, for example, our tobacco compliance operations, they are doing the purchase surveys in advance for us, and those offending locations are the ones that we then turn around and do the enforcement initiative on. So it's not that we're having to do 100% of the locations. We've got a volunteer component that's taking care of the preliminary inspections to give us direction as to where we need to go to ensure we're getting compliance at the level we need it.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience, Braden?
I have no questions at this time, but as a reminder, to ask a question, simply press 01 on your touchtone phone.
Okay. Guys, I want to thank you all for being on the program today. I want to remind our listeners that we have our annual OJJDP Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center conference coming up August 26th through the 28th. It's going to be a great conference in San Diego, California. And if you want to get more information about the conference here at the last minute, most of the hotels are full. This promises to be our biggest conference since we've been in business doing this. And at a great place, San Diego, California, where the weather's great, you can go to our website at www.udetc.org. That's Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center.org. And get more information about our conference, which is just about almost 2 weeks away. Any more questions, Braden?
I'm sorry, we have no questions at this.
Okay. Well, we're running way over anyway, so I think we'll just close it down. Before we do, Scott and Chief, can you give us your contact information with you going first, Scott?
Yeah, I can be reached through my office at 217-403-6914 or by email at Scott, S-C-O-T-T, dot Friedline, F-R-I-E-D-L-E-I-N, at C-I, dot Champagne, dot I-L, dot U-S. Don't you love government addresses?
Okay, Chief.
Phone number is 509-894-4096. My email address is raul_rudy_alnea@rl.gov. So it's my raulrudyalmeda@rl.gov with underscores between them.
Okay.
Thank you, Bill, for having us.
Absolutely. I want to thank you for being here today, too. And for our folks who are on the line, we want to remind you that this call has been recorded. And so for those participants who would like to obtain a copy of the conference call today, just send us a blank 90-minute tape.